Extension number 12571, reel 3.
That's not reel 3.
And we were attacked heavily by aircraft and submarines, and we lost 7 ships on the way, but eventually arrived in North Russia. We then stayed there for the best part of a month until the next convoy went back, when we accompanied that for a short distance, but broke off to take a patrol position between it and the Norwegian coast. This was PQ-17, which was scattered by the Admiralty, and practically all of it was lost. Looking at the reconstructed maps, it appears that the Tirpitz decided not to go for this convoy, but to return to base just before she got to our position, and she must have turned round just out of sight of us and gone home again. We then, after that, returned to our base in Scotland, and the Trident was then due for refit at Troon, and I was appointed an instructor for the crews of the new X-craft, which were building the midget submarines. And I was in Scotland for 6 months or so, training the crews that finally attacked the Tirpitz in September of the next year. I was released from that.
Can you tell me about the impression you got of their quality?
Yes, they were a very variable crowd. I mean, some were regular naval officers like Lieutenants Place and Martin. Cameron was a merchant service officer in the Royal Naval Reserve. Others, like Henty Creer, were Royal Naval Reserve officers, volunteer reserve officers, who were virtually civilians with a very small amount of training indeed. But they were all extremely keen and determined to do their best. And I went back to large submarines in the spring of 43 and went to the Thrasher and was one of the big submarines that towed a midget up to North Russia.
Can you tell me in detail what happened?
Yes, we towed X-5, which was Lieutenant Henty Creer was the captain of, and we took him up to North Russia, released him there. It was about a week under tow with the passage crew on board. The passage crew were then changed off North Norway, and we put the operational crew in, and away they went in to attack the Tirpitz. Henty Creer and his submarine were lost in this operation, and it is not known really what happened to them. A certain amount of putting things together suggests that they were hit by gunfire from the Tirpitz, but it's by no means certain. But they were lost.
What did you feel about the prospect of success at the time?
Oh, I was very hopeful that they would achieve very considerable results. In fact, they did. The Tirpitz was never any use again for the rest of the war. The Thrasher then developed serious engine trouble and had to go back to the builders for very extensive repairs. And me and my whole crew were transferred to the new submarine Trenchant, building in Chatham Dockyard. And that would have been early in 1944. We brought her out, the Trenchant, from Chatham, and set off for the Far East about the time of D-Day in Normandy. We passed through the Mediterranean and all the way to Trincomalee, and we did one full patrol off the west coast of Sumatra, which was not a particularly interesting one. The principal object of it was to be a lifeguard submarine for a B-29 raid on Palembang by American bombers. And we were there to pick up any of the crews who had to ditch in the sea short of, weren't able to get their way back. In fact, we didn't have to do anything, and it was a not particularly interesting patrol. We sank two small Japanese patrol vessels and brought back about 14 prisoners, but that's all.
Who were the prisoners?
The prisoners were the Japanese crews of the from the two small patrol vessels.
How did they react to being taken prisoner?
Well, we had the very greatest difficulty in getting getting any of them to come aboard. The Japanese principle is that you don't get taken prisoner. However, I ran between what I soon realized were the two officers who were in the water and the rest of the crew, and we sort of pulled them up the lee side after a bit. I think there were 11 of them. Did I say 14?
I think so.
No, I think there were 11 altogether. And we got them aboard. Of course, we had absolutely no way of communicating with them, so we couldn't get any intelligence. And all the book we had on the subject said was that prisoners were talked a great deal in the first 24 hours when they were frightened and didn't know what was going to happen to them, but after that they became stubborn. But of course we missed this whole period because we had no Japanese. The book was particularly unhelpful. It said the way to tell a Japanese from a Chinaman is to give him a banana to peel. Well, as none of us had seen bananas for something like 2 years in the war, this made us smile.
Was there any danger of them sabotaging anything on board?
Well, we didn't take any chances. We stuffed them in the four ends of the submarine. Had a guard on each side of them, an armed guard, day and night. But they didn't show any signs of fight at all, in fact. The next patrol, we went inside the Malacca Straits, and we took with us 8 British commandos. They were soldiers with canoes, and our intention was to blow up a road and rail bridge in North Sumatra, by doing which we hoped to force more traffic onto the sea routes, which we would be able to get at. We arrived off this coast of Sumatra. We found the bridge. We could see it in a periscope reconnaissance up a river. There were thick trees on each side, and the river mouth was rather narrow, so one only got a glimpse of it as you went by each time, but we saw it fairly clearly and let the soldiers have a look at it, and then landed them that night. They all came back in the early hours of the morning very frustrated and said the current in the river was too strong and they couldn't paddle up against it, and they'd had to give up. I decided, and it was my decision, not the commander's, that we would try next night again, because I was quite sure they hadn't been seen, or from what they told me, they hadn't been seen by anybody. And next night we landed them half a mile on one side on the beach, and they struck inland till they got to the railway, and then along the railway to the bridge, where they placed their charges on the bridge. And while they were doing so, a Japanese staff car went over the bridge, and a train. It was a combined rail and road bridge. And then they withdrew the way they'd come, but there were some natives who'd seen them doing it. And they thought they'd better take these people with them in case they told the Japanese before the charges went off. So they brought these people back to the beach with them. They then let them go because they all seemed to be going in the opposite direction from the bridge, and it seemed safe to let them go. Except one, and one was definitely trying to get back towards the bridge, and so they said, no, you're not going back that way. And they then, the major in charge of this outfit, decided that they would take this fellow prisoner. Well, if you can imagine anything more impractical than taking a man prisoner in a foal boat, which is designed for two, to take a third man in it, it just wasn't on. And after a bit, they gave this up. And they said, well, I think the only thing to do is to knock him out and leave him on the beach. So they took a frightful swing at him, and he just shook his head and wouldn't be knocked out. And in the end, they left him on the beach, very woozy, and they crammed his pockets full of the false banknotes they'd been given in case they were taken prisoner, which I don't think they could have done him more harm, actually, because the Japanese found this fellow with his pockets full of banknotes sitting on the beach. I don't know what would have happened, but we never discovered. And then the soldiers came off. This had all taken a very long time. It was getting very late, and dawn was breaking. And we didn't see them. And I decided that we'd have to give up and make off to Seawoods and dive. And I turned to Seawoods and went on to full speed to get into deeper water and nearly ran them down from behind. They'd passed us. They hadn't seen us, and they'd gone on paddling out to sea, and I picked them all up and took them aboard, and that was that. We then went on...
Which month do you think that was with the
month?
Yes.
Towards the end of 43.
44?
44, yes. August, let me think, September. I think September 44, probably. Our next patrol in the Far East, we again went into the... No, I'm sorry, the same patrol. It was the same patrol with these soldiers on board. We went on along the coast of Sumatra, as we were told to, up towards Malacca. We sank a junk or one or two small things. And then suddenly were told, late one evening, to proceed at full speed to Penang. Again, we now know that this was a radio intercept of a U-boat, a German U-boat arriving out. In fact, two German U-boats arriving in Penang the next morning. And we went at full speed across the Malacca Straits all night, got into position off Penang, the northern entrance, and submerged there in patrol. But there was an exceptionally heavy swell. Very, very heavy swell. It was difficult to see over it with the periscope, and very difficult to keep depth in the submarine, you know, it was. However, we did this, we kept depth, and after breakfast that morning, I remember listening from the wardroom as to what was going on in the control room and realizing that we hadn't had a look for a long time. In other words, the officer watch was having difficulty with the depth. So I went into the control room and said, well, get her up and I'll have a look. And I put the periscope up and there was this U-boat approaching only about a mile away. And we were fairly close to her. She was going to pass us fairly close. We went to diving station straight away and stood by all tubes. The only way to fire at this was to fire a stern shot. We had three stern torpedo tubes in a T-class. And as it whistled across our stern, very close, to about 600 yards, we fired the three torpedoes. I actually saw one of them hit just before our conning tower, and she went down like a stone. I then saw lots of life rafts on the surface popping up from the sunken submarine. We turned and went in towards her and picked up a number of German prisoners. How many, I'm not sure, but we did pick up one officer who was the second engineer, while we were picking them up, there were another five or six in the water, and these had all escaped from the submarine, from the bottom. They'd come up by DSEA or Davis Escape Apparatus or something. We were still picking them up when we saw a Japanese ship approaching. It was very, there were a lot of rain squalls about, and the visibility was very variable, but of course we had to dive at once. And I blew my whistle, which meant clear the upper deck, and all my men came running for the, to get down below as soon as they could. And they actually had one big German, and they were pulling him in, and I remember they let him go, and he went back with a splash. And they came back on board, and I was just in the conning tower, just shutting the hatch, when this German, who was supposed to climb up on his own, came over the front of the bridge and said, "Wait for me, please."
In English?
Yes, "wait for me, please," he said. And I stuffed him down the hatch just in time and pulled it shut after me. And fair trod on his fingers, I'm afraid, as he went down the ladder. And we only just got the hatch shut in time, and down we went. This was, we learned later, a Japanese patrol vessel, which was to meet them and escort them in. And I heard that it picked up the other six who we'd left in the water. We went back across the Bay of Bengal with 99 people on board the submarine. 99. You may recollect, I don't suppose you do for a minute, but I'll put it that way, that in the Thetis, when she went out on trial, she had 104 people on board. And this was considered to be far too many, and that was why the Thetis was lost, because they had all those people on board, all breathing at the same time. Well, we came back with 99 people on board, and it was necessary to surface at midday and blow through the boat to cleanse the air.
How did they behave?
The Germans were entirely different from the Japanese. The officer, we had him in the wardroom. He used to play Ludo. He was quite a nice fellow. He spoke a certain amount of English. And me and my officers of the trenchant have had quite a certain amount of contact with him since the war. I haven't met him, but I've written to him. The other German prisoners were quite cheerful. We didn't feel they were any danger to us. They were submarine ratings. They seemed perfectly happy. We had on board a machine which was for making fresh water, a distiller, which had been copied from a German U-boat. And we could never get any use out of this thing at all. It never seemed to work. And we picked up from the German U-boat the German who looked after the similar machine in a German U-boat. So we said to him, "You make this damn thing work." He got to work on it. He said, "First of all, but this is an out-of-date model," was his first comment. And he got lots more steam out of it, but not very much more water. But that's the sort of people they were. We didn't have much trouble with them. It's of interest that U-859, which was the U-boat involved, had left Kiel within a week of our leaving Rothsay in Scotland for the Far East. And while we had been going through the Mediterranean and the Red Sea and had finished our second patrol in the Far East, he had come right down the centre of the Atlantic up into the Indian Ocean, and we met off Penang. I suppose the next patrol worth mentioning... Yes, we had a number of gun actions in the Malacca Straits. We had a 4-inch gun, which was had quick manning hatches, and we used to pride ourselves in being able to surface and engage very rapidly. We did a lot of practice with this gun, and I think we were pretty good at it. And small patrol vessels didn't really worry us very much. We used to pop up and sink them with the gun. We used to find that they seldom knew we were there until the first gun went off. We nearly always hit with the second or third round, and by that time the battle was virtually won. We did this a good many times. In combination with another submarine, the Terrapin, we sank a regular submarine chaser, number 8, a Japanese one, which was a very small vessel, like an ML, but it had guns at both ends. We sank that by gunfire without much difficulty. We also launched 2 chariots. Chariots were these human torpedo things at a harbour called Phuket, this place where the Princess of Wales went the other day.
Thailand,
yes. There were 2 ships there that had been salved. They'd been torpedoed earlier. They'd been salved by the Japanese, and these 2 chariots lowered them onto the bottom again. The chariots had hoped to come out and attack the main Japanese fleet, but the Americans were never keen on this. They reckoned it was too much of a suicide business against the Japanese. And we had to use them for this rather mundane task, but they did it very well.
Do you remember the crews?
I not only remember the crews, I can't remember their names offhand, but I met them just the other day at a submarine reunion.
How did you like doing this cloak and dagger work with commandos and chariots?
Well, we didn't mind that sort of operation. We didn't mind too much landing people. We didn't like picking them up. Picking them up, you never knew whether they'd been captured and that the thing was compromised. I didn't ever have to pick one up in the Malacca Straits. although on one occasion, well, I might as well start this as a new story, but we did risk casualties in the Malacca Straits in these gun actions. And if you did get a man wounded, it was 4 days before you got home. And I always felt strongly that we should carry a doctor, if not in every submarine, at least in one submarine on patrol in the Malacca Straits. And eventually I managed to get volunteer doctors, get it approved for volunteer doctors from the frigates who carried doctors, because they had more men than we had, to come out on patrol. And this doctor that we got was an extremely nice young man, and he came on patrol with us. And another submarine had an accident where a wire, a periscope wire, broke and very badly injured a man on board. And as I had the doctor, I rendezvoused with him at night to pass the doctor over. And the doctor was to swim across. It was the only way. And I suddenly discovered, as this man was about to transfer, that he couldn't swim. Of course, we'd have never have taken him if we'd known this, but we pulled him across by getting a line across and pulled him across. I never saw him again. But the other submarine said, we're rather full because we picked up somebody off an island. Would you take him? And this man was a second lieutenant in the US Marines who'd been recovered from the beach where I don't quite know what he'd been doing. And he arrived on board, and we took him back to Trincomalee. I always remember this because he was so delighted at me taking him back that he presented me with a submachine gun. What I was supposed to do with this weapon, I don't know. It was too short a range to use in the submarine. But I didn't like to refuse it. Now, if we could go jump on, we did other patrols, which most of the work in the Malacca Straits was very small stuff. We laid mines on one occasion, and it was mostly sinking small coasters by gun and that sort of thing. There were very few decent torpedo targets at that time. And our flotilla finally moved down to Perth in Australia, where it was to operate under the American Southwest Pacific area, and therefore under American command.
When would this have been about?
That would have been well on into 45. May 45, I think, we went down there. And these patrols were very long. We went from Perth right up across the equator into the East Indies. And 6 weeks was the norm. A 6 week patrol, quite a long one. In our first patrol, we went on up to the Lombok Strait. The Lombok Strait was 10 miles wide and very deep, and was therefore